Good morning. May it please the court, Craig Cardone on behalf of William Sonoma, and I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Now, notwithstanding the numerous exemplars and web pages and web modals here, this appeal asks a single question. Did the district court err when it found there was no agreement to arbitrate between William Sonoma and class members who made purchases, created gift registries, or joined a loyalty program using specific web pages? We believe the answer is yes. I'd like to address the jurisdictional issue briefly first. This case is not Van Dusen. The district court here directed us to file a motion to compel arbitration. We did so under the FAA. Plaintiff opposed it on the ground that, quote, the party seeking to compel arbitration bore the burden to show notice and assent. The district court denied the motion using that very same framing, the party seeking to compel arbitration. Whatever label the order carries, it was a motion to compel arbitration. The order denied it, finding no agreement to arbitrate.
Well, it's kind of, the district court didn't exactly do that. I mean, you made your motion, and the district court said, I'm denying a different motion, and your argument is that arbitration was subsumed into that. But we do have Van Dusen and other cases that seem to indicate that it's got to be a denial of the actual motion to compel arbitration. So how do you deal with that?
Well, because that's the motion we filed, Your Honor. It was a motion to compel arbitration.
But he didn't rule on it, apparently. Offhandedly, all but ruled on it. I'm just trying to make sense of the district court, what the district court did in the context of our case law. So I'm not quarreling with you.
Your Honor, I don't know why the district court put a different label on the order. We didn't have a hearing on this motion. We filed it as a motion to compel. It was opposed as a motion to compel. The district court utilized the standards under the FAA for a motion to compel and then put a different label on it. That label shouldn't matter. It's the effect that matters. And I think that's really what the result was in Van Dusen, right? In Van Dusen, it may have been hostile to arbitration, but the court didn't find that there was no agreement to arbitrate. Here, the district court found that there's no agreement to arbitrate under the standards of the FAA. That is a denial of our motion to compel arbitration. It's a finding of an inability, it's a finding that we cannot proceed to arbitration. It doesn't say, as in Van Dusen, you can do this at a later date, I'm not addressing this now. He addressed it. He denied the motion, and he did so under the standards of the FAA.
Okay, go ahead.
Now, if the court thinks there's any issue with that, there is also the collateral order doctrine, which I can address, but I'd rather move to the merits if I may.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So turning to the merits, this court has been consistent that there is no checklist for conspicuousness. Courts look at the whole page and the whole transaction using common sense, and importantly, common sense that is not frozen in judicial amber, as Judge Nelson said in his concurrence in Godun. In Massel, this court reversed a district court for fixating narrowly on the hyperlink color rather than the whole page. That's the same type of error we are seeking to correct here today.
Okay, counsel, I've got some preliminary questions I'd like to ask you before you get to this.
Certainly.
So the district court spent 4 pages at pages ER 7 through 10, going through all of the infirmities in the evidence that you provided. And then at the end of that, he said that would be sufficient to deny the motion. Then on page 11, on page 12, let's see. On page 12, he says, as a separate and independent ground to deny the motion, I'm going to go through the conspicuousness. Okay. You have only appealed the question of conspicuousness. You did not appeal anything on pages 6 through 11. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So you don't challenge any of those findings. Since that is an independent ground, or the district court thought that was an independent ground for decision, why haven't you forfeited the argument?
Well, Your Honor, I think all of those grounds feed into conspicuousness. He was talking about a failure of evidence in certain of those issues, specifically as to particular pages such as the app or the mobile site, we have not appealed the order as to the app or the mobile site. So we're not seeking to compel arbitration as to the app or the mobile site. Similarly, he challenged the evidentiary showing on the loyalty program, saying we only provided exemplars for 2020 and 25 and nothing in between. And we are only challenging the order as to the time period for those exemplars for 2025 and 2020, not the period in between.
Okay. So he went through a couple of different reasons. The first one had to do with the mobile applications, and I understand that you're not challenging that. The second one had to do you also had the brands problem. So it was not you couldn't cover all brands, and I understand you're not challenging that. The third one was that time periods changed, and that he couldn't find what time periods these websites that you provided covered. And so there's no way of establishing when somebody might have seen this website and what, or when they saw a different website, or maybe they saw two different websites. And that sounds like a total failure of proof, and that's what the district court said.
Well, and we do that does feed into conspicuousness, and so we do challenge that.
But you can even if I thought, and I want you to assume for purposes of my question, that I think Judge Orrick is wrong as to at least one of the websites that you provided us. That is, that I would conclude that it was conspicuous. So if you assume that for purposes of my question, you still have the problem that Judge Orrick pointed out. We have no idea what the time frame for that particular website was. And that's his finding on page ER9, and you aren't challenging that finding.
We are, because to establish conspicuousness, we need to establish what was there. And we believe we did that.
You have no context for saying here's a web page that was up, and we don't know whether it was up for, was it up for 24 hours? Was it up for 2 months? Was it up for 4 years? There's no context whatsoever. And he's gone through the fact that your declaration from Harris admits that the things may have changed over time.
No, in fact, I mean, that's where I disagree with Judge Orrick on that. We have raised that here because we've addressed the fact that these were the exemplars that were there for various periods of time. When we say we've identified the ones that were there from 2016 to 2018, from 2018 to 2020, and from 2020 going forward.
So what do we do with the district court's findings on ER9, citing, and he's quoting from the Harris Declaration, that the shopping cart and place order pages, quote, may have changed over time, close quote.
And the Harris Declaration goes on to explain how that they did change over time and provides additional exemplars for those subsequent periods of time. Now, there may be other minor changes. Look,
other minor changes, this is also dealt with by Judge Orrick on that same page. Again, quoting Harris, they may have changed over time. And he said, but this is a fact-intensive inquiry. If they may have changed over time, how on earth can we possibly judge these if you've provided us one example, but not all of them?
Because Ms. Harris says these exemplars represent in all material respects, in terms of the place order, in terms of the checkout and the notice before each of those, what it looked like during those periods.
And we're just supposed to trust her on that?
She's the fact witness on this.
Telling us that it would have looked sort of like this. The judge has actually provided you an example of where it wouldn't.
Your Honor, I think if we had to put in every single day of every web page, that's not a standard that any court has ever come up with.
But if Harris had come forward and said, from this date to this date, this is the website that was up.
But she
that
did.
would have been different. But she has said they may have changed over time. That's her language.
There is nuance. I think it was a good witness because she was trying to be nuanced, right? There may be some slight changes, not to these material aspects of it, where the place order button is, what the font is, any of those things. And she said, these are the exemplars for how this process and this piece of it worked for these tranches of time. If I put a different item in the cart, the web page is going to look different because a frying pan is going to come up as opposed to a sheet. That's not material. And I think Ms. Harris addressed that, and she was nuanced. She didn't want to say It's exactly the same because it's not. If I put a frying pan in there, it's a different looking page. But in all material respects, she identified it 2016 to 2018, 2018 to 2020, 2020 going forward.
If we were to agree with you, and I were to find that at least one of these web pages was conspicuous, what happens now?
I think the matter gets remanded, goes back to Judge Orrick. There are arbitrability, unconscionability, and other issues that have been fully briefed, which Judge Orrick did not address, did not rule on, and he would address those on remand.
Okay, and if he were to find that you had satisfied them, now who gets compelled to arbitrate?
So that will be a question, I believe, for the district court to address. We've identified these by categories, not by individuals. So in the process going forward, Judge Orrick would need to come up with a process and say, all right, you've identified everyone from those who made purchases between 2018 and 2020. It's conspicuous. They are compelled to arbitration. We would then have a process to determine which of the class members fit within that category. And I think that's something that the district court would need to do. It would also, frankly, I think, affect the case overall if we understand that there are categories that are going to be compelled to arbitration. That makes the case easier to resolve and may save Judge Orrick a trial. So I think that's an important thing to have go back to him and try to figure out then, how do I actually ascertain who is in these categories? What's the process we're going to use for that? On the conspicuousness, before I run out of time, and I'll just reserve 2 minutes if I could take a bit of this, there are multiple ways in which these individuals have agreed. Let's just go through the checkout flow. There are two places in it where one agrees, and it's both at the beginning of the checkout and when you place your order, and the notice is either immediately above or immediately below the button that has to be pushed. I look at this case, and I think Patrick versus Running Warehouse. I was counsel to Running Warehouse in that case. This court did not even hold oral argument on it, I assume because it didn't appear to be a close call. This looks like Patrick to me. The only difference between this and Patrick is that in Patrick, the hyperlinks were green and they were under the button. And in here, they're underlined and above the button. I would submit this is at least as conspicuous as Patrick, if not more so. The other distinction I would want to make is that in Berman, Sellers, and even Cibola, if you look at those are all highly promotional situations. Contrast that with Patrick, which is a standard vanilla e-commerce transaction, which is exactly the type of situation we have here. Reputable retailer, a very relatively clean page. It's not highly promotional. I think that's a distinction that I haven't seen in any of the cases, but I do think it's a relevant one to identify here. Finally, I getting back to, we've already talked about, I had a portion where I was going to talk about the scope, and I think we've already addressed that largely. At the end of the day, the only other thing I want to talk about is the gift registry process and the loyalty. There we are talking about ongoing relationships. This court has found that where there's an ongoing relationship, it is more likely that the consumer pays attention to it. To address the comments that the gift registry page was cluttered or busy, that ignores the fact that the only way to agree to the gift registry is to have the modal come up. And the modal itself, which is before the court, is very clean. It only has two buttons, create a gift registry, and back. And immediately under that, it's got the notice that says, by creating a registry, you agree to the terms and conditions. Final point I would make, which is, again, consistent with Patrick and Oberstein, is that the terms and conditions, the links to them, are underlined. They are done exactly the same as all other links that are going throughout the site. It's underlined in the same font, in the same size, in the same color. This is not where it's being given short shrift because it's an agreement to the terms and conditions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. Judge Gould, Kevin Green for Appalese, and I'm joined by my colleague, Leonard Aragon, at counsel table. He's trial counsel. The motion here, as some of the questions have brought out, was a bit messy in the presentation and raises questions of if the motion were actually granted, who would be compelled to arbitrate and what would happen. But before I get into some of that, I want to touch on jurisdiction, because my friend on the other side said something that I think goes right to the problem here. Under Van Dusen, the court rejected what's called an effective denial theory of arbitration and said, okay, maybe that's the law in the Third Circuit, the First, the Fifth, and some have been cited. It's not the law here. And I think that's the problem. Counsel said it's the effect that matters, and that's exactly the analysis that Van Dusen just simply doesn't allow. Now, we made a motion pre-briefing for dismissal on this basis. It was denied without prejudice, I think, because it was tied up with the merits, and that's why we're here.
So counsel, what are we supposed to do with this? It's an order maintaining prior class certification definition. Maybe that suggests that it was a denial of a motion to modify the class definition. But Judge Orrick notes on page 1 and 2 of his that he denied the motion to modify as moot. He says right there, I denied the motion to modify as moot. I don't know why then we're deciding a motion to modify if he's previously said that it was moot. And he says, I directed the defendant to re-raise their request as a motion to compel. They did that. So why do we think that this is a motion to modify rather than a motion to compel arbitration?
Understood. It's very unusual circumstances. I think he did that with the intent of teeing up that. And the issue here fronted by the motion is, are there class members who should not be in the class because they are bound by arbitration?
Well, I understand. If you granted a motion to compel arbitration, it might well require modification of the class. I mean, it feels like a different way of getting there. But we do treat a motion to modify class certification and a motion to compel arbitration differently. And so the classification does have a difference, and they filed a motion to compel at the direction of the district judge. Why shouldn't we take that seriously?
I'm not saying you shouldn't, Your Honor.
Well, if we do, then we have jurisdiction.
I'm not conceding that, and I can't, because I think Van Dusen is very clear on this. And here's the point that I can't get around.
If you don't mind the interruption, the remedy is either we dismiss for lack of jurisdiction and he enters an order compelling arbitration, or we do a limited remand, right, under your theory.
No, I think the remedies, the potential dispositions are affirmance, or if there's any kind of vacate and remand, the relief sought, and this goes back to the effective denial theory, is supposedly modifying the class definition. No one is being compelled to arbitrate.
No, but we can't get there if we don't have appellate jurisdiction to begin with.
No, I understand. And I'm saying that in light of the fact that this is premised on an effective denial theory that's foreclosed by Ninth Circuit law, I don't think it's there. The factor working the other way, and I want to be very candid about this, is what the judge told them to do. And I understand. And so that's a little bit messy.
And they did it.
Yeah. And so
they didn't blow him off. They said, okay, we'll file a motion.
Yes, fair enough.
And then in his order, he denied a different motion.
But we're in an odd posture where.
Right. I'm just saying. So if we accept your theory on appellate jurisdiction, we have one of two choices. One, we dismiss for lack of appellate jurisdiction, and he likely then enters an order compelling arbitration or not. Or two, we do a limited remand and say, what did you mean?
Well, the limited remand is a possibility if we need clarification of what he said. We are in a case that's 10 years old, that we're talking about arbitration after 10 years and would like to get to some kind of conclusion, which comes through in the record from Judge Warwick. But a limited remand, if I understand the court's question, would be to obtain clarification on that for purposes of whether the court has appellate jurisdiction.
Yeah, and we keep the case and then decide it in merits if he says no, that wasn't my order wasn't compelling arbitration, then that's the end of that.
We would have no issue with that based on.
Why don't you get to the merits?
The way you describe it. And just collateral order very briefly, I think it runs headlong into the Johnson decision. It says that it just doesn't fit here. But getting on to the merits, I think the core of these cases from the judicial side is the goal of the bench to provide clear rules for businesses and how they operate on the internet and how they can enclose or disclose contractual terms that can bind parties. And this starts with the seminal Berman decision in 2022 and carries through to the dissenting opinion in Chadbola, which emphasizes the same thing. And this is against the backdrop of Sellers versus Just Answer, the California appellate decision, which is a year before Berman. And that decision, I think, really sets a tone. It's very important in terms of how you look at mutual assent and conspicuousness. And that decision says that, okay, we've looked at, we're declaring California law, and we've surveyed federal law, and we think the federal courts have been a little too generous in granting this. And so they set some standards. And then those, in turn, are developed in Berman, I think, most notably. And I think there's a very candid assessment in Sellers that a lot of this is subjective. We're trying to set markers and clear criteria, none of which are dispositive. It's all totality of the circumstances, but this feels a bit elusive in terms of what the standards are. But there is one guideline that I think stands above the others, and I think it's at the heart here of the problem with the 8 web pages. And these are discussed at the answering brief starting at page 19. And that's just simply lack of unambiguous mutual assent. Because Berman very much has in mind that we're saying that...
The district judge didn't reach the question of mutual assent. That's actually an independent basis for looking at these. He only dealt with conspicuousness.
Well, it's a little bit fuzzy because he separated them, but mutual assent is certainly an independent basis to affirm this, to the extent the court concludes that he didn't address it.
Well, yes, but that's probably not one that we would take on. We would need to send this back. I want you to suppose, for purposes of my question, the same thing that I told counsel for William Sonoma, and that is, why don't you assume that I think that Judge Orrick was wrong with respect to at least one of the pages? That I would think that at least one of the pages was analogous to a page that we have previously approved in another case and said this is visually. This is sufficiently conspicuous that it qualifies. Okay, now what? What do we do with that? If we disagree with Judge Orrick on that, are we compelling arbitration? And how do we possibly measure this? And what do we do with all of the ambiguity in the Harris Declaration that Judge Orrick kept pointing to?
Well, in the ambiguity, I think it has to work against the appellant for every familiar reason, in terms of it being there.
But if you've got
burden.
A web, but from his perspective, you've now got a website that is visually conspicuous, which means that if somebody saw this, they are effectively agreeing to arbitrate. Does that mean that we now need to find some mechanism, find some process to identify who saw that website when they bought sheets?
I appreciate the question because this goes to the discovery point that we made in our brief that's alternative, that if the court were not to affirm that it should go back on a discovery dispute, the Judge Orrick in a footnote indicated he was not deciding. And that does go to what would happen next on remand in a case where it seems like everything has happened, that is 10 years old, that is really itching to end and is prepared to go to trial. Now, in discovery, the class discovery dispute, there are three declarants here, Zagar, Quinn, and Harris. None of those were disclosed in my opponent. I'd like to hear from him on this. None of those were disclosed in the class discovery before we need to file the motion to oppose or the opposition to the motion to compel arbitration. So those declarants were not disclosed. And beyond that, we didn't get information of, let's say you prevail. Let's say the motion is granted. And you want certain class members excluded. Who is it? I mean, because we have some idea of who they are. Notice has gone out. It went out by mail to specific people. That showing hasn't been made. So in terms of what would need to happen on remand, I think that would have to be sorted out, but it raises the question of why wasn't it sorted out earlier and into a failure of proof. So I think if this is not affirmed, it does create yet another rat's nest in this case. And I think it should be for... a reason on mutual assent, if I could just get to this, because I think it's a flaw in each of the 8 web pages. Now, keeping in mind that no single guideline is controlling or dispositive, there's the color of the font, the size, the location, what else is on the page, and et cetera, that all the courts talk about. But Judge Watford's opinion in Berman says Well, the assent has to be unambiguous and explicit. And Sellers versus Just Answer says that means that it's very clear that the parties are talking about the same thing. Now, the dissent in Chadbola makes the point, and I think it's a fair one, that in today's world, we all buy things on the internet, and it's subject to terms and conditions. However, this is inquiry notice, where none of those terms are actually on the page. You know, wouldn't it be nice if you pulled up one of these and there was, say, a bullet list of foregoing arbitration, foregoing jury trial? None of that's there. I mean, you've got to click on the link and know to click on it and know what you're agreeing to, which is the mutual assent. And so I think the guidance, which is repeated in at least three decisions on, and this is a through line that I think is the clearest guidance on mutual assent that's in the decisions, the most consistent, starting with Berman. That you need someone clicking a button or checking a box that indicates, that almost causes them to pause reading the page and realize, okay, I am agreeing to this, to the same thing that the defendant has set forth. So there's a very simple example, and it's not magic words, but this was laid out in Berman in terms of what businesses should do. By clicking the continue button, you agree to the terms and conditions. That's pretty clear. And that's in Berman, Chadbola, and the dissent, and Godun, the Godun decision. But none of these pages do that. I mean, they leapfrog over that pause that I described. And so they all falter on mutual assent, I think. And on conspicuousness, there's some variation in the pages. Some are more or less conspicuous than others, but the terms and conditions are buried and not set forth in separate colors in a way that I think you get to that we're agreeing to the same thing. And that's the problem. So I don't have much more to say on conspicuousness unless there are questions. I want to address one thing from our answering brief that we could have said a little more clearly, and that is at pages 31 and 32, there are images of the two key rewards pages. And those images are actually a bit busier than they appear in the excerpt. And I want to invite the court's attention to excerpts of record 142 to 145 on those two pages in particular in terms of what the consumer actually saw and what was presented. So in short, if we were to write the decision we would like to see, it would be that Judge Orrick is affirmed for the reasons stated in his order. Because the opening brief here really struck me as unusual in that it doesn't really acknowledge any of the rationale that he gave for anything. I mean, it just describes the procedural history, and then it's that, well, it's a de novo standard, and here are the web pages, and arbitration should have been compelled. I think you have to do a lot more than that. And so his reasons really are not challenged, and I think a basis to affirm this.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll hear rebuttal. Why don't you put two minutes on?
Yeah. Thank you. On the jurisdictional issue, it wasn't an effective denial. It was an actual denial, a finding that there was no agreement to arbitrate. You can't get around that regardless of label. Counsel has, I believe, conflated the concept of mutual assent and conspicuousness. The notice and conspicuousness concept comprehends and addresses mutual assent. That's one way of establishing it. Judge Bybee, if you find that some of these are conspicuous, but you have a problem with the Harris Declaration and you don't think it adequately covers the whole period of time, I think what one has still found then is that there is a process where someone was bound. And we know that existed at a period of time. And on remand, the Judge Orrick can figure out what period of time that
is.
Yeah,
it's just a little frustrating at this point because I can tell that Judge Orrick is frustrated with you. And he's going to say, we've been going on for a long time. You had a full and fair opportunity to do this, and you didn't do it, and therefore there's a failure of proof. And we can go back and just do iteration after iteration. But at some point, that iterative process has got to be said.
I do think he's wrong there. I do think the Harris Declaration satisfies. But even if it's narrow, right? It still has to go back. It still should be reversed if it's conspicuous, because we've presented an exemplar. The only question is, what period of time does it cover? Who's covered by it? Not is it conspicuous, and is there, should the arbitration be compelled? On Sellers, counsel said that that was California court saying the federal courts had gone too far. I want to remind this court, Sellers was decided under the California auto renewal law, and that was the distinction between some of the federal decisions, which had a higher standard for assent. Again, I go back to, on this discovery issue, the question was, why wasn't this sorted out earlier? It's a very simple answer. The class wasn't certified. There was no ability to deal with this earlier because we didn't have a certified class.
Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case just heard will be submitted for decision and will be in recess for the morning.